It's a virtual currency which only exists on the internet.
Many financial experts dismissed the cryptocurrency as a fad and thought it would ultimately prove worthless.
What is Dogecoin?
Well, it actually started as a joke based on an internet meme.
Is it the solution to the world's financial problems? Is it a new decentralized form of currency that could radically alter the world economic system?
Oh my God, $39,000.
Nobody owns or controls Bitcoin and everyone can take part.
Burn more fossil fuels in the middle of climate change to make fake money? It's ludicrous.
And my goodness, the price is volatile. Look how much the exchange rate for Bitcoin has fallen.
I'm gonna tell you how I lost $100,000 in cryptocurrency.
Hello and welcome to Bare Naked Politics, the podcast for people who want to get their news and current affairs stripped back to the basics with no assumptions that you have any prior knowledge whatsoever. And when has that attitude been so necessary than today when we're talking about cryptocurrency? I'm Julia Bell and I'm usually, I like to think, a bit of an authority when it comes to the topics that I discuss on my podcast. I've talked you through Brexit, the pandemic, the American elections. If it's political, I can handle it. But where I am perfectly happy to declare that I am a complete moron is in the world of crypto. So I thought, why not learn about this together? Because I have to tell you, I hate not understanding stuff. I hate feeling left out. That's why I started this podcast, is because I assumed other people hated feeling left out of politics. This is what I feel about cryptocurrency, and it's not going away. Crypto is just continuing to dominate financial news, and I'm over it. I want to understand what's going on, so I reckon it is time that we face the music and understand what the hell it's about. You will be relieved to know that I brought in an expert to explain this stuff. Joshua Shigala is talking to me in the bulk of this podcast. He has been a pioneer in the Bitcoin space since 2010. He co-founded a company called Voltoro.com. It's the first ever crypto and gold exchange, the first ever. And he recently also co-founded a decentralized finance project called TheStandard.io. If you don't understand what the hell I just said, absolutely fine. Neither did I. And Josh did take the time to explain it, which was very handy. So take a breath. This is the last moment that you are going to not understand this. If you listen to this podcast all the way through, which I really recommend you do, then you'll get it. What a nice thing that you're about to enter, is you're about to enter a phase of your life where you finally get what the fuck this crypto thing is. Kind of try to engage your brain, because it's challenging something that you have had your whole life. You've had traditional money, traditional finance systems your whole life. You've never had to think about anything else. So your brain will hurt, but that's okay. And before we get into it, please make sure you are subscribed to the podcast, or that you've hit the follow button if you're listening on Spotify, and follow me on social media at JuliaBell_X to keep up with me in between episodes. And without further ado, no more hiding. It's time we understood this thing. Okay, now look, like I say, crypto is pitched as the next money, the next way to trade and buy and sell and keep your wealth. Bitcoin was the first cryptocurrency. It was the pioneer. But now that there is this loose formula that was created by the inventor of Bitcoin, there are thousands of different types that have sort of taken that loose format and played around with it. So there's Ethereum, for example, Litecoin, Cardano, Dogecoin, which you heard a clip in the beginning, Elon Musk referred to it. It was actually started as a joke, Dogecoin. But now there's serious money in it, and it goes up and down. And it, you know, there are thousands of these different cryptocurrencies. It all sounds completely bonkers, and I get that, but there's a lot going around. So how does it work? How does it actually challenge money? Basically, at the moment, when you go to a shop and you buy, I don't know, a bottle of champagne for 30 quid, I'm making a hypothesis that I want. You go to the shop, you buy a £30 bottle of champagne. You present your credit card or your debit card to the shopkeeper, and their device speaks to your bank. It asks your bank if you're good for the money. Does this person have 30 quid in their account? The bank then checks its ledger that has all your details and all your transactions on it. And it tells the shopkeeper either yes, this person has 30 quid, or no, don't accept it because they're not good for the money. When you make the sale, if you're good for the money, the bank then sends that 30 quid to the shopkeeper. When you tap your card on that device, your banker sends the 30 quid to the shopkeeper and updates your ledger. Easiest thing to understand in the world, right? We all get that. Crypto sacks off the bank. It poses the idea that banks having control of your money and having oversight over your ledger is unfair. Because they say, well, what if the people in charge of that bank are corrupt? What if the bank is incompetent? What if they give out too many loans? This is a story we all know too well. What if they give out too many loans, it can't get the money back, and it goes bust? And you lose the money from your account through their bad decisions, through no fault of your own. So crypto says, okay, let's eliminate the bank. Let's have a digital currency where this time when you go to the shopkeeper to buy your bottle of champagne, instead of that shopkeeper's device asking your bank to look at your ledger and to see if you're good for the money, it instead asks a network of a gazillion computers, a vast network all over the world. Is this person good for the 30 quid? Although it wouldn't be in pounds, actually, it would be in, let's say, Bitcoin. So it would ask the network, is this person good for £30 worth of Bitcoin? Which I think is like 0.001 of Bitcoin. So instead of having your personal ledger that's overseen by a banker or by a bank, everyone has access to everyone's ledger. All of our dealings are all put onto the same ledger, the same spreadsheet. So anytime anyone all over the world makes a transaction with this cryptocurrency, in this case, Bitcoin, the universal ledger is updated and it keeps updating all the time. And that universal ledger is often referred to as the blockchain. So just remember that term because I can't remember if Joshua used it, but now you get it. That's the mass spreadsheet. And the kind of elegance of that comes from the fact that nobody can tamper with it. Because if they tried, you know, if you were feeling a bit dodgy and you thought, you know what, I'm going to put an extra £1,000 on my ledger. If you tried to do that, you would have to do it on a computer. So you'd be on your one computer in this vast network of gazillions of computers. And you update your one ledger to say, oh, this account has £1,000 extra. Then all the other network of computers would go, well, now your ledger doesn't match ours. Your one ledger doesn't match our gazillion ledgers. So it'd be dead easy for them to spot the odd one out and reject it. Does that make sense? You're completely held accountable by the network. You can't just spring a little bit more crypto into one account because the whole network would go, well, where did that come from? We know where everything is, where everything's being passed around. We're able to track it all. And we can't track that. So, sorry, forget it. Are you with me so far? So this is kind of global accountability that comes with cryptocurrency. There's no one person in charge. There's no one bank that approves or disapproves of your transactions. It's actually up to a load of computers to all agree that you have enough in your account or in your wallet to buy that champagne. And when you buy it, the mass ledger is updated, the blockchain is updated, and all of those computers now know that your wallet has 30 quid less in it, or 0.00 something of a Bitcoin. That's the basic principle. Done. If you're with me so far, then you fucking nailed it and you're going to get on well with this podcast. If your brain is hurting, sip your coffee and get over it because this is what you're in for. We're challenging traditional currency or fiat, actually. That's your last bit of jargon. Joshua often refers to currency as we know it, so pounds, euros, dollars, as fiat, traditional money. It basically means it's been approved and assigned a value by a government. And crypto, I guess, could be thought of as an opposite to fiat because it kind of holds a middle finger up to government. It's not interested in a government assigning it a value. All right, basics covered. Enough from me. Let's jump into my amazingly enlightening conversation with Joshua Shigala. And I want to do a quick disclaimer. He is just here to educate, not to offer financial advice. And same for me, obviously. You are rational. You already knew that, but these things have to be said. So Joshua, I'll come to your company and what you do shortly, but we just need to start off way more basic because I'm not ready to understand what you do yet. Listen, there's people listening to this who, much like me, feel incredibly left out of this cryptocurrency conversation. It seems like an intimidating, sort of closed off world. So for us total novices, what is cryptocurrency?
Wow. Well, the thing is that we first, to understand cryptocurrency, you have to understand money. So let's just step back a bit. So when government creates money, most of the money that's made, all of it is created through debt. So what does that mean? It means that the government lends money through bonds, gives the power to the banks to lend new money, which is usually through mortgages. So a new mortgage, they don't get someone else's money and give it to you to buy a house with. They print new money and they ask for interest in return. And why that's kind of unfair is because there's always more interest owing in the system than there is money.
Right.
So kind of like a musical chairs, there's more money owed back to the system than there is in the system. So there's always going to be people that don't have anything. It's a kind of weird thing to get your head around. It's like money is lent into existence with interest.
Right.
So imagine it like an island. Like, let's say there's no such thing as money. You're there, I'm there, and there's one other person, right? And there's three people on this island. I say, I've got this great idea. Usually we just swap chickens and eggs and chores. But I wake up one day and say, hey, I've got this new thing called money I've invented. And you say, okay, great. How does it work? Well, you know, you can use it with everything because I know you're sick of having my painting. You have already too many of my paintings, so you don't want to swap for them anymore. So let's have this thing called paper currency. And you say, okay, great, I'm sold. Let's go. How do we do this? So what I do is I lend you the first money. That's how you get the first money. You say, fantastic, all right, let's go. You say, wait. If I lend you the first 10, you have to give me 12 back. And you're like, huh? How does that work? There is only 10 on the island. I've borrowed the first 10. And I say, well, you're going to have to wait for Bob over there to also borrow 10 and maybe do a trade, get 2 off of him. And then you can pay me back your 12 and everything's hunky-dory. You say, okay, all right, let's do it. So you borrow 10, you owe me 12. Bob borrows 10 from me. Now there's all up $20 on the island. And you've taken the 2 off of Bob by swapping something, selling something to him. He's happy. But he owes me 12 as well. Now he only has 8. And you've paid me back. So now there's only 8 on the island, but 12 is owed. And this keeps on getting worse and worse and worse as time goes on. And that's why governments create more and more debt in the system. They just try to get more and more debt into the system to keep this sort of... almost like a Ponzi scheme, because you need more people borrowing, new people borrowing to make sure the old don't run out of liquidity. So if you zoom out of that little island, you're kind of looking at Greece or right. Cyprus or these countries that have so much debt, but not enough money to pay back the debt. So inherently, there's something wrong with money that is created as debt. So if you have a look at gold, for instance, very different. It isn't lent into existence. Someone goes out there with some hick with a hat and a pick, and they try to find gold. Now they put some work in, they find this gold and they spend it into existence. It doesn't need to go back to the ground with interest that doesn't exist.
The ground isn't expecting it back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So gold is an asset that's found. It's a rare metal. It's found. And it's spent into existence. And this is where cryptocurrency comes in. So cryptocurrency is not a rare metal. It's a rare number. and so a rare number is very, very hard to find. It's a very tricky math problem that all these computers are trying to figure out. But it's kind of like a Rubik's Cube. It's a very hard puzzle to do, but easy for everyone to verify. So you can look at a Rubik's Cube and go, oh yeah, they've fixed it. They've done it. They've solved it. And for that, the system generates 25, or originally it was 50, new Bitcoin into the system. But I don't want to confuse you too much. Basically, what it means is that there's people putting work in, trying to find these rare numbers. And there are mathematically only 21 million of these rare numbers. There cannot be any more. Just like 2 + 2 can't equal 5, there can never mathematically, absolutely certain, cannot be more than 21 million of these rare numbers. And these rare numbers have just the name coin. So if you have one of these 21 million, you have one Bitcoin.
And have they all been found? All of these 21 million numbers, have they all been like realized?
No. There's about 6 million left or something like that.
And what happens when those 6 million are found out as well?
Well, this is the amazing thing. So if you hold some savings, let's say you've got £10,000 in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
That over time, your government prints more and more and more, especially during big economic events like the pandemic, where people are printing stimulus to help other people out, and they're printing new money into the system. Eventually, that money becomes worth less and less. So if you imagine it like cakes, if I make you a cake and I have 1,000 cakes and they're worth, you know, I don't know, $10 each. Now, if I started to make 10 million of the exact same cakes, after a while, they would lose value if it's in the same marketplace. After a while, it's like, well, everyone's got that cake. I'm not going to spend 10, I'll give you 5. After 10 billion of those cakes, you start to go, well, they're like worth 10 cents. Everyone's got one of these. So instead, Bitcoin, what you do is you take one cake. You cannot print more cakes. You cannot make more cakes. Instead, you slice it in smaller and smaller slices. So instead of printing new money, you make the same money worth more and divisible further. So the pound is divisible by 2 decimal points, right? You have cents, you have 1 cent or penny. And a Bitcoin goes down to 8 decimal points. So in actual fact, one Bitcoin is enough for the entire world because we can always add more zeros. So cryptocurrency is basically a way to have something that's the rarest thing on the planet. And most things you can recreate. And Bitcoin, there's provably absolutely only 21 million of these numbers.
Okay, so Bitcoin is just a name for a rare number or an answer to a really hard sum that takes work to get hold of, and the work to get hold of those rare numbers is done by miners, as they're called. And that work, just like with digging up gold, is kind of what gives the Bitcoin its worth, in theory. And there's only 21 million of these answers or these numbers. So again, like gold, it's finite, which gives it its value. That bit, I can completely get my head around. and then, to sort of summarize the last bit you were talking about, just for anyone who's massaging their temples right now in despair, the thing that you can do with Bitcoin and other cryptos that you can't do with dollars or pounds, with fiat, as you call it, is you can divide crypto into a bunch of decimal places. Like you say, a pound can only be divided into pounds and pennies, but a Bitcoin can be divided down to 0.00001 of a whole Bitcoin. So that inherently solves the problem that you often find in wartime or like you say, in a pandemic, where governments find themselves printing more and more money to try to bail everyone out because they can't divide their money down past the penny. They can't add any more decimal places in. And then, like with your cakes, the value of that money, because there's so much of it, just goes to shit. There's too much of it, so it doesn't mean anything anymore. That idea reminds me of those photographs of post-war Germany and those, you know, the famous photographs of people literally bringing wheelbarrows of cash just to the bakers to get a loaf of bread because the currency had been so overpumped into the system that it became worthless. The fancy term for that is hyperinflation, isn't it? Where too much money is printed and it loses its value. And I suppose from what you've said, theoretically, Bitcoin, by being divisible and finite, addresses that problem, correct?
Yeah. Not only did Bitcoin solve this, and this is where it gets, when most people have the aha moment, with digital things, it was a very, very hard problem to solve where you take a digital thing and you can't copy it. So if I have an MP3 and it's worth nothing really, because I can just send you a copy of it. You can't say, send me that and know that I haven't got it anymore, you know?
Definitely. I understand what you're saying. I work with MP3s all the time because they are audio files. So when I send somebody an audio file, for example, if I send an episode of my podcast, I still have the original file. I've not sent them it and then lost it. You know, me sending it to somebody does not stop me from keeping it. Whereas I suppose with money, if I transfer a tenner to somebody else, that tenner comes out of my account categorically.
Exactly. So Bitcoin was the first digital thing that couldn't be copied. All I can do is send it to you and you absolutely mathematically know that I don't have it anymore. And this was a computer science problem that had been really almost impossible to solve for the last 40 years. And Satoshi Nakamoto, who invented Bitcoin, solved this problem.
And you know what I'm going to ask? How? How has it solved the problem of digital things being finite insofar as I send you this and I don't have it anymore? Explain that to me, please.
Basically, these miners, they're doing complex computer problems to find these numbers, these rare numbers. And what happens is that when I find that, I'm like, wow, I've got it. And this is a Bitcoin. I'm like, yes, this is worth now 50,000 US dollars or however many pound that is on the exchange rate. So I'm happy now. It's worth a lot. So I find, you know, you're selling podcasts, and I think, wow, I'd love to donate to this podcast. So I send, you've got a little Bitcoin address, and I send you one. Now, what your computer program does that accepts that is it looks and traces it back to where it was found in the mathematical problem. So it says, okay, it came from this address, and maybe it didn't come from me, maybe it came from three people ago. It follows the track back, all the way back to where it was found, and says, oh yeah, that's the mathematical problem. It created this and it did three, you know, hopped to that person, to me, and then I sent it to you. So that's a real one. If I made a Bitcoin out of nowhere and sent it to you, your computer program will go, hang on, it came from me, but it just came from nowhere after that. Like, that's weird. No, it's invalid because it doesn't trace back to that computer program, that Rubik's Cube that I solved.
So it's as if every single person's computer who's involved in these transactions has the ability to trace everything back. And then it's as if they're all connected on the same network. They can all see every single receipt of every single transaction. And that's how, if one comes through, they can all look at it and go, no, that's not from anywhere.
Exactly. Okay. So that's because what is Bitcoin trying to do? It's trying to stay decentralized. Like, all of these problems could be very easily solved if I was Josh Bank and I have a central server, and every time a transaction comes, it goes through me, I check if it's real, and I send it through to you. But this is terrible, because if I become corrupt, you know, you would basically always follow what the tyranny wants you to follow, because you have to eat. And yeah, so this is the main thing that Bitcoin was solving, was this centralization. And so to be centralized, that's why you need 51% of the network to say yes, rather than a single node that can be corrupted.
So you would rather rely on the word of 500,000 computers than one government to verify your transactions.
Exactly. Or to not be able to freeze my transactions.
Okay. Is Is cryptocurrency traceable and taxable?
It most definitely is traceable. So, for instance, you can, if I give you some Bitcoin, you can see the address that it came from. You know it's me because I've talked to you. But what if you just have a donation address and you see 0.5 of a Bitcoin just arrive? Lucky you. But you could then see where it came from and the wallet and how much is in there. And you can actually then trace it back to the wallet before, but you don't know the people behind that. If you, there are very clever systems that can take those addresses and try to find, oh, look, that address also paid this shop, and the police go to that shop and say, who paid this invoice? And you say, oh, it was Mr. So-and-so. Oh, okay, so that must belong to that wallet that paid you.
Okay.
So there are ways. So that's why they call it not anonymous, but pseudonymous, which is like pseudo-anonymous.
Right.
Yeah. Which is, I think, a good middle ground.
Right. Although Bitcoin does kind of get stored. So it is a physical, because I know that it's technically the sort of digital asset. However, I read a story about a guy, actually a UK-based guy, who accidentally threw away his hard drive that had millions of pounds worth of Bitcoin on it. And he's still in an argument with the council to try to get access to the dump so that he can find this hard drive, because he would be a millionaire if he could find it.
When did the penny drop that actually what you'd thrown away was worth a fortune?
When I started to hear stories of, you know, the Silk Road shut down, and obviously other individuals making their profits and their millions, the penny dropped then, you know, that I had 7,500 bitcoins on a hard drive that I'd thrown out a few months ago.
So for people who don't understand virtual currencies, they wouldn't have thought it's a problem throwing away a thing, a hard drive. But to get your money, you would need that hard drive.
Yeah, there's a specific file on that hard drive called a wallet file, which the Bitcoin is stored in. And without that file, there is no way of getting the money back, because there is no central server that records a log of it.
You've spoken to the manager here. They've been very nice to you. They've driven you around, but they've warned you there's absolutely zero chance of finding it.
Basically, yeah.
So it is a physical, tangible object that can be taken, right?
Yeah. So what Bitcoin actually is you imagine like a letterbox. You imagine a letterbox. That's what Bitcoin is. So now, when you give that, it's made up of public keys and private keys. It's kind of a stupid name. It should be public address and private key. So your public address is like the front of the letterbox. You can put Bitcoin in. I can send you Bitcoin. I can put that in there, but I can't send it without having those the private keys to open the back of the letterbox and take out that Bitcoin and put it somewhere else.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, the letterbox thing is actually really helpful, because you can really easily pop a letter through someone else's letterbox. But if you don't have keys to their house, you can't get that letter back. It's not like you can fish around. You can't stick your hand in there and fish around and grab a letter from the doormat and take it back out again. You have to have a set of keys to get inside the house and retrieve what has been put through that letterbox. So with this poor guy that's chucked away his hard drive, he is, as for, with this metaphor, this letterbox metaphor, he's able to stand in front of his house and look at his letterbox. He can see in the windows that his whole house is filling up with mail, filling up with money, but he can't get inside. It's actually so sad.
Yeah, it's really painful. I heard another story of an actually person I kind of know in the industry, but you know, he made one of the very early Bitcoin videos, and his keys are on a special hardware device that gave him five or something guesses, and he forgot, and he's down to the last guess. Otherwise, it gets wiped automatically, and
jeez,
it's like hundreds of millions.
But this is the thing: as much as banks do you over, they crash, they loan out more money than is in the government's pot, they don't give you five chances to get your password right and then wipe your account, right? You could go into the bank, prove your identity, bring your passport, do everything that they require of you, and you can get your money.
That's right.
This concept where it's all digital, you're reliant on passwords, you're reliant on technology when you're only able to do that with your human brain, which is not flawless. That terrifies me.
Yeah, it might terrify you, but the good thing about Bitcoin is you can have both options. You know, we run an exchange called Voltoro, and Voltoro is basically a custodian. You can send us the Bitcoin, and you can trade to gold and back to Bitcoin, physical gold that's sitting in a vault. And because Bitcoin is very volatile in price, so gold's fairly stable. And then if you lose your keys, you can send us an email, and we'll, you know, with some ID documents, you can get back to me. And
So with the postbox analogy, you're like when you give your neighbor a set of keys and you say, see, if I lose my keys, can I come around and get them off you?
Exactly.
And people pay you for that service.
They pay us for the trades. So they might trade. It's free to hold crypto by us, but then you also have counterparty risk. If we lose the keys or if we get hacked, which has never happened in the last 5 years, we're very secure. But, you know, by holding your Bitcoin on other people's exchanges, you do trust them that they aren't going to lose. There are solutions, like insurance companies are now starting to grasp the whole concept and are starting to insure these companies.
Okay.
Wacky.
I mean, it's just too, like, I can, obviously your whole world revolves around this, but I'm not there yet with it. Just to kind of delve into this a bit more, cryptocurrencies at the moment seem to me to act like stocks. They're volatile, and they're something that people, it seems to me, invest in rather than buy so that they can spend. I don't know many people who buy Bitcoin so that they can then directly spend the Bitcoin. I know people who buy Bitcoin because they're trying to be smart and they're trying to watch it increase in value so that they can get their cash back out of it. And by cash, I mean real money. And so for me, what I'm trying to imagine is a world where cryptocurrency is the money that we're all using.
That's right. Yeah. Well, it takes time. You know, the reason why Bitcoin has these huge bull runs, meaning it starts appreciating in price so much, is because it's in what's called a price discovery phase. This is a new technology. Mm-hmm. This is a new weird thing, and no one really knows what the value is. So it's trying to find its value. People are like, oh, it's way too expensive. And then it'll, you know, they'll sell, and then it goes right down. And, oh, it's way too cheap. And so we don't really know what this thing is worth yet.
Did the inventor of it have something in mind, or did he never have that equivalence planned out?
He or she or they, because it was an anonymous person.
Oh, I thought it was a man. Okay, an anonymous person. Of course it is.
Ah,
God's
sake. Yeah, they dropped this information. Like these computer scientists have been trying to figure this problem out for many, many years, and they just dropped it onto a mailing list and disappeared, like worked on it for a while.
Wow.
And then disappeared. But because they knew that this is extremely dangerous, you're going up against governments, you're going up against banking system, you're going up against, you know, this is why countries get invaded, you know. So they didn't say this certain amount, but they created the fact that there will only ever be 21 million units. So if you take that and you think, well, there's, you know, how many billion people on the planet, if they all eventually start using Bitcoin, then one Bitcoin could be worth $1 million.
Right.
So it's, and that's why people are like still saying, oh, it's still extremely cheap at 50K. But I remember when it was, you know, $30 and people were saying it's too expensive. it's always had the moment where it's been too expensive.
And it's still kept going up generally.
It goes through these boom and bust cycles where it goes right up. So first it went from a dollar, it went up to $30 and then crashed down. And everyone's like, oh, it's over, it's dead, the project's finished, look, it's crashed. And in fact, there's a video of me on YouTube where I talk about that it's gone down, and the comments are like, but it went down from $30. What do you say now? And I'm like, have a look at the fundamental technology. Don't look at the price. The price is a distraction. the fundamental technology is that you have the first rare digital asset that can't be copied, functions like true money, hard money like gold, is a bearer-based instrument that no one can confiscate from you, and it's transferable worldwide in a second. Not only that, it's programmable. So I can say, if the sky is blue on a Tuesday, then send it to Julia. Like, you know, there's all this programmable component to Bitcoin as well, which makes it really interesting. We might need to do another show about that.
I need a new brain if we're going to talk about that. We obviously keep referring back to Bitcoin, but there's different kinds of cryptocurrency, aren't there? So there's Bitcoin, but there's also this Ethereum that I keep reading about. Is comparing, let's say, Bitcoin and Ethereum, is that like comparing euros and pounds, just two different currencies? Or are they so different with different algorithms and different technologies that it doesn't bear trying to compare different cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, you can definitely see it as euro and pound. But okay, you can also, so Litecoin, for instance, was what's called a fork of Bitcoin. It means they took the code and they forked off and changed a few parameters and created this Litecoin. So instead of 21 million, there's I think four times as many Litecoin that can ever be mined into existence. And it's
so,
like four times
as many rare numbers.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
But you can't send a Litecoin to a Bitcoin address. Like, they're two individual systems.
And can you transfer them? Like, you can go, you know, you go to a currency exchange and you say, like, I've got 40 euros. I know it's going to cost me a bit to do this, but can I swap them into pounds? Then you come away with like 33 quid or whatever the exchange rate is.
Exactly. Exactly.
You can do that with crypto.
Yep, absolutely. Okay. And, you know, this was one of the things that a very famous economist said years ago was, why can't we, money hasn't changed in terms, it hasn't had an upgrade for many years. In fact, it's been downgraded. We moved away from gold and just had governments print it out of thin air. We should have free and open money where anybody can create currency. And this is effectively what we've done now. Mm-hmm. Bitcoin is the biggest because it was the first, and it's got a big network effect, meaning lots of people have wallets and there's lots of infrastructure built around the Bitcoin ecosystem. But why can't you have, the Julia coin?
Mm-hmm.
These things are so open and amazing that you have the option to do that now. And a lot of artists are doing this now. They're creating what's called NFTs, which make coins out of their paintings. So they'll say, I have this artwork, and you can follow this artwork through. So you know that this is an original Julia painting. I know, like, this is an original because I have the cryptographic proof. I have the coin that goes with that painting. And now the aftermarket, I can now sell that as an original, and they know it's an original because I've got the token.
But that's ridiculous to me, because we're talking here about an image online. We're not talking about me making a painting, which I do paint. So this is why my brain is like exploding. Me creating a painting on a canvas, putting the work in, as you say, that bit is there, the same. But then I'm not sending you the physical painting. You're just buying an image of it, which can be, because we were talking about MP3s earlier, talking about songs, you can just send that to anybody. So the idea of you owning the original, to me, seems worthless, because still we can all have a copy of my painting digitally, but you owning the original therefore means that your copy of it means it's worth something. This is another area of cryptocurrency that just blows my mind. Why are we buying into this concept? It just seems ridiculous to me.
It's wacky, right? It's wacky. I really didn't think it would work either. But what it does, it's not that I have the right to look at the painting. Like, I could definitely make a copy of any NFT and just have it as my background, or put it into a printed out and anything, you know?
Yeah.
But this person that has the NFT has the right to resell it, meaning someone else knows that this is originally from you, and you're the person that created that NFT, that token. And so this has got direct lineage back to the artist.
But why would anyone want to buy it when they can just have it? Like, this is why. So, for instance, a picture of a dog. I paint a picture of a dog. I take a photo of it on my phone, and therefore that's a digital image of it. And then I say, right, I'm going to make this into an NFT. And therefore I'm going to give it to you as a gift, Joshua, because you did this podcast for me. And if you want to resell it, you've got those rights because you've got the original NFT. It's yours, even though it is a digital picture that I could then also send to all my other pals. But you have the original. And you're, why would anyone buy that off you when they could just get a copy of it online? It's a digital bit. It's like when you go on Google Image, type in a, you know, for instance, the first ever tweet is an NFT, isn't it? The picture of that tweet is an NFT. So somebody somewhere has paid a really sickening amount of money to own that. Even though I, Julia Bell, can very freely go onto the internet, type the first ever tweet into the internet, find the image of it, save it to my computer and use it for whatever I like for free. Somebody has still bought it. What the hell?
Well, you know, the market's a crazy place and sometimes the market acts irrationally. So there's a famous story about a tulip bubble in the Netherlands. There was this mania around tulips. The tulips came and people were starting to buy these amazing, beautiful tulips. And these bulbs started going for thousands and then millions. And then the famous part is these kings were selling whole mansions for three bulbs that were red and blue. And like, and eventually the mania got so massive and then it crashed because someone, some smart ass figured out, wow, well, I can just import a shed load of these these tulips. And of course that happened and you had this big crash in the tulip prices. And so a lot of people referred in the early days to Bitcoin as a tulip bubble.
Right.
Well, anyone can create Litecoin or DigiCoin or Bitcoin or Rainbow Coin. You can create whatever. So what gives this value? That it's valueless. The fact of the matter is they didn't count on the fact that none of these are interchangeable. Bitcoin is Bitcoin. It works on the Bitcoin network. It has a network. If how many people have Bitcoin wallets? How many exchanges accept that blockchain? So it gets value from the network, just like social networks, like Facebook has value because so many people are on that network. And it's very hard for me to come along and create Facebook 2, Josh Book or whatever, and say it's the new social network and no one uses it. It's like got no value because no one uses it, right? So this is really where the value comes from.
And that's to me kind of part of the fallacy, is that the only reason these things work is because people have bought into it. That's kind of, for me, it's like a wish in a cloud of a ghost wrapped in a riddle. It's not real. It doesn't exist. But we've all bought into it and therefore it's worth something. And then when Elon Musk tweets, I love this, we all buy more of it. And it's worth more because we're all buying more. And then he tweets again, I don't like it anymore. So it plummets because we don't want it anymore. But it's not there. Like, this is why I can't cope.
Well, look, like I said, it's in a price discovery phase. And a lot of people have sadly become sheeple. Like, this is really not just a normal, not just a conspiracy term. It's really a term, and you see it. You take one influential person, and just the fact that we have these people called influencers mm-hmm. really shows that a lot of people will buy something. And like any supply demand thing, if there's a famous person that's selling doodads and everyone is like, wow, those doodads are amazing, then, and they only make so many of them, then the price will go up because more and more people want them.
Can I ask you about you then now? Obviously you've watched this world and gone, I want to play this game. I want to create businesses that play this game. Talk to me about what you do.
Yeah, so like I was very lucky to have an interest in alternative currencies and alternative economies a long time ago. I created the world's first swap site where people would swap clothes. But I realized that back in, you know, this was back like 2001. And I realized that people swapping is a very inefficient way of working, a way of market, because if I really love that dress of yours, but you don't like anything that I have,
right,
then a deal falls through, right? And that's unfortunate.
And I might be ready to give up this dress, but I just still don't want anything that you've got. Right, okay.
Yeah, so what do you want? You want a token of value that works in an entire marketplace, that you can take that token that I give you and go to someone maybe that you do like something of theirs and they would accept that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I created Swapstyle, and I realized so many deals were falling through because of this problem. And I started looking around and thinking, oh, I wonder if someone's, because I don't want to create the bank, because then it just goes back to central banking. Then I'm the central bank. And then how many of these coins do I create? Do I create as debt? It's a big can of worms. So I was already looking for a way to create a type of decentralized money, a money that was just working in a protocol of credits. I stumbled across what the cypherpunks were doing or trying to solve, but it seemed unsolvable at the time, that money couldn't solve that double spend problem, meaning exactly what an MP3 is. I send you the MP3 and then I send someone else the MP3. And it's like, that's the double spend problem.
Yeah, this issue of how do I make a digital currency that is finite? So when I send it to you, I don't have it anymore.
That's right. Yeah. And it seemed like an unsolvable problem. And then in 2010, the paper that Satoshi Nakamoto wrote, who was the anonymous inventor of Bitcoin, came across my table, and I thought, oh, wow, you know, she's cracked this problem. It's stunning. This is such a beautiful mechanism, because it's, while it's complex, if you really look at it, it's also very simple and elegant, the solution. And so then I fell down the rabbit hole, and I put into Swapstyle, which was the site back then, an ability for people to start using it, and no one knew what it was. They were like, oh, what's this Bitcoin address thing? I don't know. Never really took off. But nevertheless, I started this trip down this path. And then Mt. Gox was a large centralized exchange. It was the first Bitcoin exchange in the world. And everyone had their money in there. Not everyone, but a lot of people. And then it went bankrupt. It got hacked. And there was big headlines like, the CEO of Bitcoin got hacked. And, you know, because no one knew what Bitcoin was. There is no CEO. It's a decentralized protocol. There is no ruler. There is no central party. It's a mathematical program that's just running constantly on thousands of computers.
Yeah, the ruler is a gazillion computers.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so when that happened, when that exchange got hacked and everyone lost their money because someone stole the private keys of everybody by hacking the exchange, that's really when my brother and I sat down and said, let's build an exchange that was truly transparent. So yeah, then we built Voltoro, which is an exchange where people trade for gold rather than fiat. So if something happens to us as an exchange, it doesn't matter, because the gold belongs in your name as your legal property. So people can trade into a physical allocated good that's sitting in a vault. It's just a chunk of metal. We haven't gone back to fiat. We haven't gone back to paper currency. You're still holding a rare asset. And then you can trade back to Bitcoin when you want to spend it.
So when people go onto your, like the trading platform, Voltor, is that what it's called? Voltore.
Voltoro, like imagine like vault, like a gold vault, and oro, which is the Spanish word for gold.
For gold. Voltoro.
Yes.
So this is like derived from the swap shop idea, but instead of swapping dresses for shoes, you're swapping gold for Bitcoin. Is that what you're doing?
You put it so perfectly, it's amazing. And then back again, so gold back to Bitcoin.
And the reason that you use gold, physical, actual gold that is sitting somewhere, rather than money, as what I know it, pounds, dollars, is because you feel like money, we're having to play the bank's game with money, whereas gold, that's a physical thing. It's never going to go away. It's always going to be worth something because somebody had to put work in to get it, and we can control it ourselves.
Not only
that. That's why you use it.
Yeah, we can fully audit it. Like, try to get an auditor to audit Deutsche Bank. you won't know how liquid they are. You won't know anything because it's so, even they don't know how liquid they are because it's so complex, all their instruments. Whereas a bar of gold is a chunk of metal. It can be fully insured and it can be counted. And it sits in a vault and it's there.
Yeah, I get it. You're winning me around a bit.
Oh, my brain.
There's still this cloud wrapped in a ghost under a riddle. Like, I still feel a little bit of that. What would you say then to anyone listening who's thinking about dipping their toe in the water? What would the first step be for them to be thinking about this responsibly?
Stay away from anyone that's saying they're going to be the next Bitcoin, basically.
So stay away from shitcoin, as people call it, the new stuff.
Yeah, like just if you're new to this space, stay away, try to understand the concepts, try to fundamentally understand what it is and, have a look on let's say CoinMarketCap and have a look at the top 10 list. If you're going to buy anything, stick to the big ones for now. I mean, this isn't financial advice whatsoever at all during this entire podcast. In fact, I would say don't even buy any. Try to work for some. Do the job that you do. Try to accept Bitcoin for it. Say, hey, I will accept Bitcoin for this. And get your download a wallet. You can download a smartphone wallet. And learn, go onto YouTube and whatever wallet you download, type in how do I secure my Bitcoin properly and just learn how to use it.
Well, listen, I feel a bit lighter about it.
Oh, that's
because,
great.
Because I've kind of penetrated it slightly more. Because what for me initially felt like a world that I wasn't invited to, more now feels like this is what people are doing to try to be sensible. We're not there yet with it, but this is us trying to protect ourselves.
Mm.
And that's kind of the merit of it, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's, the saying for Bitcoin was be your own bank. That's what we started off as, be your own bank. And we have had thousands of years to learn how to secure hard assets like gold in big vaults with men with guns and stuff. But we have had all of 12 years to understand how to secure digital assets.
Yeah.
So we're still, humanity is still learning. And that's why a lot of people say it's still a good investment because a lot of people still don't understand this space. So there's a lot of room to grow.
Okay. I might make a little pledge to the listeners. I might buy a tiny slither and then keep you guys posted and just tell you what's happening with it and try and get myself educated on it. And I'll talk you through my journey with it because I am as novice as it gets. And I feel quite frustrated by stuff I don't understand. So this has been a frustrating journey for me and I've only just started. But I am determined to unpeel it. So I might make a pledge to show you, kind of try and pull the curtain back and show you my experience.
Well, I'll tell you what, you get a Bitcoin address up on to this show in the show notes. And, we'll show it around the community and see who donates.
That sounds interesting. I don't even know what that means.
Well,
let's do it
and then you will.
And it'd be good to stay in touch. I feel like you're someone I should know in case the government starts charging $5,000 for a loaf of bread. I could be like, Josh, could I get in on this gold business?
yeah exactly. Look, it's highly probable. The average lifespan of a fiat currency is all of 27 years until
wow.
Goes to bust. There's been ones like the pound, as sound as a pound, but even that's lost, the pound has lost 90% of its value over the last 100 and something years. The US dollar's lost 98% of its value in the last 100 years. As we were kids, I think we can all remember some mixed lollies at the tuck shop would cost you, like 10 cents or something.
Totally.
And now it's, $5. So
yeah, there's a running joke actually in the UK. You might be familiar with it. It's called a Freddo bar. Have you heard of them?
Yeah, Freddo Frog.
Yeah, the Freddo Frog. And the Dairy Milk bar. And they used to be 5p. And now they're £1. And they're literally a slab, a pathetic slab of chocolate. And honestly, it is like this symbol of hyperinflation to us because we all remember it tangibly. And it's such a short time ago that it has whacked itself up in price so exponentially. And when you think about that in terms of a house that we are trying to buy on the same salary, teachers, for example, get a very similar salary to what they got when Freddo bars were 5p, but they're having to buy a house for 750 grand on the same salary.
Well, and a lot of people think, oh, wow, houses have gone up so much in value, but they haven't.
Right.
What has happened is the fiat currency that you're buying it in has gone down in value.
Right. I'm going to burn all my notes.
Don't do that. Just put it into something that's tangible.
Thank you so much for taking the time. I realize that we've now spoken for like an hour and a half or something crazy.
It's my absolute pleasure.
Okay, take care.
Okay, cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
Josh Shigala there, founder of Voltoro and thestandard.io. I will leave his Twitter and his details in the episode description if you want to check him out. Thank you again to you, Josh, for taking the time, because that was a rough ride you were in for. I asked you like the same question 10 times over, and it sounds to the listener like it was a really smooth chat because it's all edited down now, but God, if you could hear the raw copy of that, it was brutal. Right, let's do a quick summary then, shall we? Because there's pros and cons of crypto, and I want you to go away with a nice full picture. Is it a fad? Is it, you know, a ghost wrapped in a riddle or whatever I called it? Or is it here to stay? So pros, first of all, number one, it genuinely does seem to democratize money. There's no government, there's no bank. We are all equal and accountable in this system. It can't be dominated by one corruptible person. So it does become more democratic just from that idea. Also, second pro, it's international. If this were to take off on a more practical level, if you could actually use crypto day to day and buy like a house with it or a sandwich, then we are on a level playing field across the world all of a sudden. You can go anywhere and not have to worry about exchanging your pounds for whatever it is they use in your destination. You don't have to worry about the strength of your currency versus theirs because you'd be using the same thing. And also you wouldn't have, I mean, this is the bit that hurts most of all, is when you have to pay to swap your money for another currency. It's just annoying, isn't it? You're kind of paying for the privilege to spend your own money. Doing that sucks. And in theory, if we all used cryptocurrency, you'd never have to do that. It's an international currency. And then the final pro is, well, I'm sure there's loads more, and I'm sure there's lots of crypto nuts that would be really offended to hear me just outline three. But for simplicity's sake, one more pro is that it's instant. There's no 2 to 3 business days. There's no maybe we'll process your payment at some point and you'll potentially get it in your bank account. It's instant. If I send you the crypto, there it is in your wallet within minutes. So it's like sending a picture to somebody on WhatsApp. It just arrives. That is a nice idea, especially, you know, I'm talking to you as a freelancer in a pandemic. And my God, have I had trouble with companies saying, oh, we'll process your payment and maybe you'll get it at some point. If we were in a crypto world, I could just say, no, no, pay me in Bitcoin while we're on the phone. And I could watch it land in my wallet and then let them off the hook. Do you know what I mean? That is a nice, warm, fuzzy idea. It's no more of this processing and waiting times and business days and months. Ugh, end of that. Cryptocurrency is instant. That is a fucking lovely idea, to be honest. But then there are the cons. And the cons are pretty serious, in my opinion. The first con is that it is horrific for the environment. It is. Powering computers to act as this network, but also to mine the coins. Remember when Joshua talked about those incredibly difficult puzzles, those math equations that these computers are doing to try to find these rare numbers? That takes a lot of computers. You get entire power banks in America and China that are dedicated to wiring thousands of computers all together, tens of thousands of computers that are all wired up and who are all whirring away desperately, doing sum after sum every day to try to mine these numbers, to find these numbers, to complete these equations. So even though the crypto itself is digital, the computers involved are very real physical, tangible objects, they take up space, and you better believe they use a lot of electricity. Now, this is a hotly debated topic. Some people look at this and they say, how is this acceptable? Most of us don't even use cryptocurrency. We're not benefiting from it. And yet, here these kind of select few people are draining the world's natural resources for them to access these coins that they can spend and earn money from, while we all just sit watching our own planet's power resources be drained on something we're not even benefiting from. That's so unfair. We're facing global warming. This is not a priority. It should stop. So you definitely get people on that side of the fence. However, there's people on the other side who favour cryptocurrency who will say, hang on, we're presenting a challenge to banking. And how can you possibly quantify how much energy and how much of the world's resources banks use up? Think about all the fat cats that jump on private planes every other day. Think about the fact that they print money onto plastic. You know, you'll probably know that our notes are made of plastic. That doesn't sound very good for the environment. And then, of course, you've got to think about all the actual computers that are in the banks and how many gazillions of employees are all there using computers. This, if we just focus on crypto, we would eliminate that. And then we can just focus on trying to power our computers on water, wind, hydrogen. So the people who are pro-crypto say it's not really fair to say we drain the world's resources when so do banks, and we're trying to challenge that. I suppose it's up to you to decide how you feel about that, but I would definitely recommend just YouTubing like cryptocurrency, the environment, and you can see videos of these banks of computers whirring away, and they make quite a noise, all wired up together, desperately trying to mine these coins. And it does look like a bit of a middle finger to the planet, to be honest. Okay, another con, in my opinion, and this is probably for me the big one, is that it's just not easy. It's just not easy. You can't. It's hard to understand. It's hard to follow. It's hard to educate yourself on. It feels quite elitist. Maybe that's not intentional, but that's how it feels. And you know, as you heard, I said in the call with Josh that I would set up a Bitcoin wallet. I'm gonna talk you guys through that process. But I've spent the last 2 days looking into this, and it's not easy. It's not obvious which website to use, which apps to use. There are different options, and they all have upsides and downsides. And it's all on me to work out what to do. So it's really not kind of grandma friendly. You need to have different passwords. You need to have access to the internet all the time. You need to have a device. So if cryptocurrency were to genuinely pose a threat to banking, traditional banking, they would need to come up with a way for non-tech savvy people to understand it, to get on board with it, because otherwise it's never going to work. You know, I remember when the iPhone first came out, and everyone was a bit like, oh my God, that's like a computer. How are we going to function with that? But they made it so user-friendly, didn't they? Little pretty pictures. It's all touch screen. It's all bright colors. It's laid out in such a way that your very flawed human brain could very quickly get on board with it. Bitcoin has not been like that. It's just not, in my opinion. And then, of course, the most obvious con for everyone is that it's just so, so volatile. This whole crypto space, as it's referred to as, you know, yes, what Josh said made sense. The technology has intrinsic value. The technology makes sense. So in that essence, it's a good idea and it should be worth something. But the way that human behavior is affecting its value is what's scary. We're all panic buying it and then we're panic selling it. And we're treating it like this really volatile stock. And if we stopped fucking doing that, maybe it would even itself out. Maybe cryptocurrency would establish an actual value and we'd be able to understand what it's worth, what it means, and it'd be relatively consistent. But because of our behavior, there is this really strong chance that you could buy tomorrow, you could buy some Bitcoin or some Ethereum, and then some influencer somewhere could declare that it's over, that it's dead. Oh, don't buy Ethereum, it's bullshit. It's over. The next thing is the new big thing. And then you're left with a hard drive and a password that gives you access to sweet fuck all. That's frustrating, that's scary. And a lot of people have been, you know, in a YouTube hole over the last couple of days, watching videos where people describe how they literally lost £100,000 overnight because they neglected to get out in time, and then a crypto plummeted. But all of the same, you know, I've outlined the pros, I've outlined the cons. If you really get it, if something about this really speaks to you and it resonates as a genuine challenge to currency as we know it, then Mazel tov to you. You know, keep me posted with how you do. Maybe in 50 years' time, when the government and the banks all fucking lose our money and crash, we'll be knocking on your door asking for help. Who knows at this point? Oh, and just to harp back to this thing, I mentioned to Josh, and I do mean it, if you don't even want to go there with this and you think, do you know what, I'd rather just watch someone else lose their money, which is a very sensible policy, I am going to do that for you. But I'm only going to literally invest a slither, you know, 30, 50 quid maybe. So if you are a patron, then you will exclusively be able to access my journey in this. I'm going to give you updates with how I get on. I'm going to do videos. I'm going to show you whether it's a horrific process or whether it's quite enjoyable. I'm going to show you if I lose money, exactly how much. I'm going to completely pull the curtain back. I'll show you what websites I'm using, everything. And I swear to you, I'm such a novice, it hurts. I really don't know what I'm doing. So I'm having to get the advice of friends. I've roped Joshua into guiding me through this. If you're interested in becoming a patron and watching all that happen, the link is in the episode description. And doing that, becoming one, really helps me keep these podcasts going. Make sure you follow me on social media at @JuliaBell_X. As you know, I mostly talk about politics, which is an area that I do know about. So if you have questions for future episodes, then you can always shoot me a DM. And I wish you the most pleasant of days. It's a big weekend coming up. We've got the Euros final. England made it in, apparently. It's coming home, I'm told. So by the time I do another episode, maybe we'll know what happened with that. But very importantly, in my little world, Bare Naked Politics has been nominated for a British Podcast Award, and the awards show is this Saturday, 10th of July. It's outside, and the weather is set to rain all day. And I've got this lovely big dress that I'm wearing, so wish me luck in that respect. But more broadly, wish me luck in the bullseye category. I'll keep you posted with how I get on. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you for listening, and I'll speak to you in the next one. Okay, goodbye.